Hello and welcome to the second event of the 2012 Milton S. Eisenhower Symposium season. Before we introduce our highly esteemed guests, we'd first like to thank President Ronald Daniels, our advisor, Dr. William Smedic, and DeSaga for co-sponsoring this event.
This year, we proudly celebrate our 45th anniversary of the MSE Symposium. This year's theme, The Power of the Individual, How One Voice Can Change the World, is intended to address how technological advancements and the importance of individual action will impact the future, and how we as Hopkins students can interact and ultimately prosper in a rapidly exchanging world.
Lieutenant Dan Choi graduated from West Point in 2003 and served in combat in the Iraq War in 2006 and 2007. His many activist roles range from getting arrested to creating the Nights Out at West Point, In his own words, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell isn't short-term politics. Please help me welcome to the stage Dan Choi.
Thanks. Good job. Short and sweet. All right. Thank you. Baghdad, Iraq was an area known as the Triangle of Death. It was the most dangerous area in the entire Middle East at the time, and some would say the most dangerous area in the entire world. We were patrolling one very hot afternoon, sometime in the afternoon where you would normally hear the call to prayer. We thought that we were overwatching a Sunni mosque. They told us two things about Iraq: they're Sunnis and they're Shia. We thought it was a Sunni mosque, and so about this time you would hear the call to prayer from the minaret, beckoning the Muslim faithful to pray and worship together as a community. And we heard something very different from the Humvee, from the megaphone. Allah musalli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjal farajhu al'anaduhu ansar walidahu maqtada. Maqtada, maqtada, Ya Allah, Ya Muhammad, Ya Ali, Ya Mahdi. That was not the call to prayer, and it was not a Sunni call to prayer either. Our intel was wrong. Now, that was not the reason why I was most surprised, but I was surprised because it was a Shia political rally for what we thought was a Sunni mosque. Why it was so surprising to me was I knew that for centuries, the Shia people were discriminated against and hunted. They were targeted. They were called worse than non-believers. They were infidels, worthy of death. It was so rampant, this discrimination and hatred, that some of the Shia leaders would tell their own people, the Ayatollahs and the Sheikhs would tell their own people, if you are ever in danger of losing your life, if you are hunted or you're targeted because of who you are, you don't have to tell anybody who you are. God will forgive you. Better that you live and you do good work. This was a philosophy called the taqiyya, loosely translated concealment or hiding. Taqiyya was exactly what we didn't want anymore. See, we were in Iraq with the notion that we were going to help people to build up a government. Pluralistic government means a lot of different people come together, work together. They all have rights. Every single person has access to their federal government's resources. Equality. You shouldn't be afraid to say who you are. So what I was surprised is on that minaret, from that megaphone, you're hearing strains that would not have been heard for hundreds of years. Shia people proclaiming themselves against this philosophy of taqiyya, of concealment. See, I would go up in front of tribal meetings just like this, and I would start off with some of the most famous poetry in all of the Middle East. Al-khaylu wa-laylu al-bayda'u ta'arifuni wa-sayfu wa-rimhu qartasi wa-qalamu ana iladhi nadhra li'amal al-sha'ri wa-asma'i kalamati min bihi sammu. The horses and the night and the desert, they know who I am. They know me. the sword and the spear, the pen and the scroll. They know who I am. They know me. I am the one that can make the deaf to hear my poetry. And I am the one that can make the blind to read my prose. They know who I am. They know my name. They know me. It's a very powerful poem, huh? A very powerful poem and a declaration of identity. No matter what, they know me. They'll remember me. And we remember the name of the guy who wrote this, Mutanabbi. Over 700 years ago, he wrote these powerful strains. And this is what I wanted to tell the people in Iraq. No matter what your discrimination, no matter what your identity or whatever family you came from, no matter how rich you are or poor you are, what we are trying to help create here is a government that's open for all, that all of our resources belong to all, and you all have a responsibility to give back into it. That's what pluralism, that's what democracy meant. And then I come back home. And I deal with my own philosophy of taqiyya, codified in don't ask, don't tell. And my identity, even though I help Iraqi people to share their identity without shame, without fear, without concealment, I have to come back home and I fall in love for the first time and I still have to hide. You know, they asked me to go back to Iraq. They asked me to go for another year and a half. And I wanted to go back, but I felt like I had a place in the world where I could help with the skills, the things that I was given. I wanted to go back to help a little bit more because I thought the job wasn't done. I thought my friends are out there suffering. They're hurting. My Iraqi friends, my American friends. But because I fell in love for the very first time in my life, can you imagine 27 years that you've never fallen in love, never dated, never had a girlfriend or a boyfriend? But now I'm finally understanding. Well, you people keep talking about love, and you hear it everywhere. It's in your face all the time. I'm not just talking about Valentine's Day, but it's on the movies and the radio. I know now what you talk about when you say commitment, loyalty, and mutual respect, mutual decision-making, equality in the home, in the family, no matter what goes on in the day. I could go home to that person. And that one person will say it's okay. And I said, what if I go back to Iraq? What if I go to Afghanistan? What if I go anywhere and I get killed or I get seriously injured? Is it not the job of that person, that one person I love, to worry the most? That's their duty. And when I wondered, could I do that? If I come back home, in a flag-draped coffin, will that flag be folded up into a neat, crisp triangle and a general with white hair on bended knee? Who is he going to give that flag to? On behalf of a grateful nation, we thank you for your sacrifice. Who will he give that to? Will it be my true love? See, I finally understood what all you straight people talk about. And I was not going to stop loving. Because then I realized it's not just for you people. It's for me too. I realize not all of you are straight in here. But I said, this love thing, why shouldn't all my soldiers be able to understand that, gay or straight? I understood my soldiers more. You know, as I said, I understood what you guys sing about on the radio. All you need is love. Love is all you need. Your love is like a roller coaster. Baby, baby, I want to ride. I want to ride. Your love has got me looking so crazy right now. Got me looking so crazy in love. Got me looking so crazy in love. Oh no. I said, that's for me too. Yeah. Genuine saying, ride it, my pony. I'm just a bachelor, baby, looking for a partner. I understood all these songs now. Maybe that's beyond your time. I felt that I needed to. I even understood Lady Gaga. See, I'm not done. I even said Lady Gaga. What she sang. Actually, I don't really understand Lady Gaga even to this point. My poker face, poker face. She's got to love nobody. That's how I felt. I said, why should I have to hide what I know is true in my heart. And everybody asks me, but, you know, I understand that. That's a nice story. That makes it all sappy. It makes me feel warm and fuzzy inside. But, Choi, you knew about don't ask, don't tell, so why did you come out when you did? Did you not know? You just want to break all rules everywhere you go? You gay people just want to switch around and break all rules everywhere? And I say, you're right. You're right. You're right about that. I didn't have any excuse to hide for as long as I did, for 10 years in the Army. And when they pressed me for the real reason why I came out when I did, the answer is very simple. I'm Korean, and my mom just got so damn annoying. She asked me one question. And Korean people, you're going to be offended, so you might as well leave now. This is going to get real bad. She would say one thing. When I came back from Iraq, she would say, when you met a Korean girl, what you want to breakfast? I met a Korean girl. Mother want a lunch? I met a Korean girl. What you want to dinner? What you get the master degree? I met a Korean girl. Marry Korean girl. It's my translation to you. I know sometimes I need subtitles when I imitate my parents. I realized that that was the reason that it got just so annoying. I said, Mom, I am not going to marry a Korean girl. She looked at me. Her eyes got, you know, her eyes got all big as a Korean woman's eyes could get, like this big. And she said, what do you mean nobody Korean girl? Nobody wants a girl, don't nobody wants a girl! I said, okay, I gotta translate this a couple times for her. I'm not going to marry a white girl, all right? I'm gay, that means I'm not going to marry a girl. And she thought about it for a minute, and she said, you know, because we were raised in a very Christian tradition. My parents are Southern Baptist, and that always confused me, in case any of you were confused. And usually when I go down to the South, people are like, oh, we get it. But I know right here it's like semi-South, so I have to kind of explain this. I asked my dad all this time, too, like, why were we Southern Baptists? Do you know what they do? And he said, well, we from the South Korea, so we're the Southern Baptists. We're from South Korea. So according to him, anything Southern is better than anything Northern, especially when it comes to the Koreas. So when why did I go on that? Okay, so I told my mom, and she's so religious, she asked me this one question. She said, okay, you're the gay, but you can pray. Do you pray? How many of you are raised in a Christian tradition? How many of you are raised in Christian tradition? So I guess I'll see the rest of y'all in hell, is that? All right. If you're raised in a Christian tradition, at the end of a prayer, what do we say? In Jesus' name, amen, right? And my mom said, if you say this, then you pray no big game. Yes, you can. You can pray. You can change. We believe. Like Obama said, yes, you can. Yes, you can. She said, you can change if you pray. How you pray? You tell me how to pray. And I would say, okay, I'll be so desperate sometimes. I will be at these church revivals and these retreats, and I would cry. I would say, God, please. I was like in fourth grade. I would say, God, just please let me wake up tomorrow morning and pop a boner for Michelle Pfeiffer. In Jesus' most holy and precious name, above all names, amen, 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 amen. She looked at me, how you pray like this? How you pray like this? The people that want sin. This is a big shame. Who did she miss? Michelle Pfeiffer. Who did she Michelle Pfeiffer? It's a big miracle that she pronounced Michelle Pfeiffer. Who did she Michelle Pfeiffer? Is she not a Korean? You should pray Korean, girl. Then God answer your prayer. Pretty much, we are yelling at this point. It's funny now, but it was pretty serious. This was my coming out serious heart-to-heart with my mom. My dad wakes up. This is a Saturday morning. So I guess when a Southern Baptist minister hears about boners and Michelle Pfeiffer in Jesus' name, he's got to be part of the conversation. He comes in, and he says, what's going on? And he's about to sit down, and my mom grabs my hand and says, I love you, but you tell Daddy. And so he's about to sit down. What's going on? He's waking up. And I'd say, I'm gay. My dad shoots right back up and he says, since when you gay? Since when? He's very analytical, see? Since when? I wanted the timeline. I wanted the report. I wanted the analysis. I wanted the receipts. I wanted my money back. He's going delirious at this point. He said, "You, this is not a genetic. This is not a DNA. This is a sin, number one sin." So we've had conversations like this for 6 months. I decided, you know, my Korean Southern Baptist immigrant parents, they weren't like your white liberal parents, okay? Stop trying to say we're all the same. I decided I have to live at home for 6 months. I had to occupy Reverend Choi's house. And so it got awkward. And I realized that's why my sister advised me, do not come out. Well, this was 2009, so I've only been out of the closet for a little bit. I'm working on the whole Beyonce dancing thing. I'm working on it. I'll get there with your help. But, you know, my sister, she was very worried about me. She didn't know I was gay. I told my sister, I'm dating this wonderful woman. And all the details were exactly the same. The age, the location, the race, and the name. I was dating Matthew. And my sister was always like, oh, I want to know about Matthew, or Martha, because I said, I got to change the name. So I chose Martha. Matthew, to this day, does not forgive me for making him into this name, Martha. He's just like, that's not a sexy name. Hello? He would like, that's not a sexy name. That's the most unbelievable name you could ever be. I know you got don't ask, don't tell. That means you're stupid. Martha? I'm sorry if there's anybody named Martha in here, but you're probably really sexy, okay? Just not to me. But Martha, I'm telling my sister, Martha this, Martha that. I can't stop talking about Martha. And she says she wants to know. She really, really wants to know. And she didn't know that I was gay the whole time. And when I came out to her and I said, all the details, I have one thing to tell you. You know, Martha, actually there were two things that I told her that were not the same. Matthew. Here I go, I still mess it up. You know, the reason why I did that was because I thought I would be drunk a couple times, and if I were talking about Matthew, I didn't want that name to slip, so I just picked, like, M-A, you know, T-H, and so that would all, like, the averages, I could quickly correct myself. I thought, I try to think about all of these gay people, always trying to think about the contingencies, always talking about Plan B. So my sister said, you know, I didn't know you were gay, it's going to take people a long time to know, and I said, okay, I have to tell them, because I've held this for 27 years, and you never had to tell our parents your truth of who you date. You know, the worst thing that you got was that you were dating a white guy one time, and she almost got disowned for that. But I had to explain to my sister, I realize what's in your heart. You just don't want it to be awkward for you in the home. So that's why you told me to wait for 1 year or for 2 years. Wait till you're 50 years old. And then finally she just said, wait till daddy dies and then tell him. Then you can come out and then you'll be safe. And I realized that the advice that we get sometimes is contrary to the truth that we know in our hearts. They say, you need to wait till after this election cycle, for instance. You need to wait till after we get a Congress that will allow you to come out. You will have to wait until this ballot initiative to get married. You will have to wait before somebody else does it. You're going to get in trouble. So wait till after that. The same idea. Why? It's not to benefit us. It is to prevent their awkwardness. And so I got the same advice that I got from my sister in the public square. But what I always went back to in my journey and my activism was my experience coming out to those two people who judged me the very most in the entire world. You know, you could go to a pride parade. You could go as an ally, you could come out. Pride is not a parade. I love those feather boas. I love the rainbow flags. But that's not what pride is. If you are truly proud, truly proud, then you know the truth. And that truth is what you are proud of. You own that truth. And so I always went back to those lessons that I learned at home. when I came out to those two people who judged me the most. You are not out until you tell those people. You realize that. You could be out to everybody and say, I am a leader, I am an activist, I am proud as I punch, everybody knows. Or you could even say, well, everybody knows anyway, I'm so flamboyant. Or they can just assume, because I haven't been married yet, that's a bunch of BS. You have not gained the courage to come out to those people who judge you the most because you're a chicken shit. And until you do that, you will never be out. Don't pretend like you're proud. You are not proud. You are ashamed. And that cowardice is all of the world telling you that you are not allowed to come out yet. You are not allowed to do it because I'm going to be awkward. Forget those voices and remember the values that you learned at home by those people who judge you the most. They do have a right to judge you. They taught you those lessons that should remain blaring in your head and in your heart. Honor your father and mother. You know, when my dad said this is the number one sin, I knew all the commandments. I sat through all his sermons, just like my straight brother did, just like my younger straight sister did. I said, I learned the same thing. You call this the number one sin? You told me the number one sin was not to accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. But what was the number one command, Daddy? Because I heard you say that many times. Love your neighbor as yourself. And many of you, how many of you heard that verse before? It's not just a Christian verse. Love your neighbor, do unto others as a, but what does it mean? What does it mean when, what is implied by that meaning? Love your neighbor as yourself. In order to show God's love truly, fully, comprehensively, you must do what? You must first love yourself just as you are. God made you gay. God made you lesbian. God made you bisexual. God made you transgender. God made you queer. God made you as you are, and he blesses you in that way. You are born that way. If you don't believe in God, believe in Lady Gaga, all right? Lady Gaga said it. Yeah, we got one applause right here. Lady Gaga is right. You are born that way, and you're born this way for a reason. You have, yeah, as I say it again, Lady Gaga was right. Is right, continues to be right. She's a rightly guided caliph here. Lady Gaga says, born that way, why? It's not just enough to be born. You have a purpose. You are living in a time right now. If you are gay, or if you have gay friends, and you have a chance to fight for marriage equality, for civil rights, for this question six or whatever's going on in this state, for anything that's going on, don't just limit it to one ballot initiative. In your life, you have a duty now, a responsibility and a blessing to go and tell the straight people, to the homophobe, to tell them, yes, love is worth fighting for. Yes, love is something that we want to buy into. Yes, it is an honored value. Yes, it is the thing that glues us all together. We need to be reminded of that. Some people take marriage like it's a given. They invite gay people without even realizing what pain it causes us sometimes. And we always buy the nicest gifts. We always do the best decorations. We even wear the nicest dresses. But when you ask your gay friends, what does marriage mean to you? I don't really give a damn if they don't believe in the institution of patriarchal marriage, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. No, you're so smart. Good for you. Some people want to be married because it shows that love is important in a way that non-smart people can understand as well. Love is not just for people with PhDs. I love you people with PhDs. I know there are some in here. But remember this when your teachers and your professors and even the people sitting next to you in class or even right now, when they remind you, think about me, they remind you, I might be awkward. We would never be here with civil rights. We would never be here in our country. No progress movement, no any movement ever succeeded by waiting on someone else to do the job for them. You live in a moment where you can make a difference bigger than anybody 50 years from now, 100 years from now. So you think it's hard? Yeah, it's hard. Some things aren't supposed to be easy. But it's a blessing because you get to live at this moment. Because your one thing you say, or that you don't say, will echo that much louder. Can you imagine Now we're on the streets. And, you know, they taught us, all of our elders taught us this very important chant, this legal equality chant, right? And you probably heard it. What do we want? Equal rights. When do we want them? Now. And so some of you have heard of it. And we changed that. We didn't want to use that anymore because that was a legal argument and a temporal argument, you know, that, you know, we want it now and we want rights. That's very important. And we even had, hey, hey, ho, ho, don't ask, don't tell has got to go. That was funny, that was nice, but I wanted our group to learn something more fundamental, something that struck down deep in the heart. And we used three words that were made famous and were made most critical in the civil rights movement for African Americans in this country. So great people like Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King and Fred Shuttlesworth, Reverend Shuttlesworth and Reverend Ralph Abernathy and all of the great leaders taught these three words. And if you know these three words, they will replace any chant that you ever have to think of. I am somebody. And why were those words so important? I am somebody. Was it about me and being empowered? Yeah. For people who are oppressed, it certainly does make a big difference. I want you to practice, all right? This is going to be like church. Say after me. I am. All right, so I am. Somebody. I deserve. Full equality. Right here. Right now. I am somebody. I am somebody. I am somebody. How many of you felt like you were just a little tingled and you felt like you were a little bit somebody just by saying that as quietly as you did? Some of you, although I know you guys didn't even say it. You guys are like, this is hokey. I don't want to help you. I'm anti-gay. That's what. All right. Let me tell you a secret about this. Let me tell you a secret, the gay secret. All right? Shh, just between you and me. All right? Don't tell these people on the radio. When you say that to yourself, it makes you feel good. But that's not what it's about. When you go on the streets and you're marching, you say, I am somebody, I am somebody. You say it loud enough that other people can hear. Because you're not saying it for you. If I get my grammar right, the I is the first person, right? But here, the first target is not you. The first target is you are somebody. Because when they see, and can you imagine, people chained up to the White House fence in the uniform of the country of their service, where they would devote their lives, chained up, fired from their jobs, unable, disbarred, or prohibited from even contributing, chained up, ready to go to jail, so you could do to me what you want, even with the discrimination that exists today. I am somebody. You can lock me up, you can't shut me up. I am somebody. You can keep on charging all these bills. They still try to get $3,000 out of my paycheck, taken away from my veteran's disability. To this day, I get three phone calls. I had to shut my phone off because I knew they would call right now. I'm still being prosecuted. Two trials right now over in D.C. court. I'm the defendant in a criminal trial for the protests of the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I still say, I am somebody. So what's the hidden message there, if you don't get what I'm trying to say by now? If I can say I am somebody, as a gay American today, discriminated and oppressed, shunned and kicked out of families and churches around this country, then what the hell is your excuse? If I can stand up, then where are you? The person that looks and walks by and says, I'm an immigrant, but these people are citizens and they want to serve. And what are they saying? I am somebody. I am somebody. I am somebody. Don't you ever doubt the power of the one singular voice of what you can do, what you can say. It's not selfish to fight for your rights at the time when you don't have your rights. Don't put party first. I'm not looking for a party. We're gay. Everything's a party for us. Everything's a celebration. Put others first. Put the other person first. Think about them and think about the power. When you say, I am somebody, we are somebody, it affects that person. You don't know if the person right next to you, even sitting there right now today, you might smile at each other. You know, you might want to keep up appearances. You look good, people. And in class tomorrow, your teacher, the people that are your teacher aides, or the visitor, or even the civilians that come, the non-students that come up, the security guards, all these people that come in and they just see you. They might be having the shittiest day of their lives. They might want to commit suicide that day. You don't know that. I'm not going to cherry coat or sugarcoat it. I'm not going to say that this world is easy. You know, even in college, in this year, as you finish this semester and you go on to graduate or you finish up the next couple years, these might be some of the most difficult times, most stressful times, most harrowing times. And what you need, you don't need somebody to tell you that you're a victim and to pat you on the back. What you need is to confront that victimization yourself. Why? Not for yourself, but for the other person. That's the only cure to this. When you stand up and say, I am somebody, you put everyone else on notice. Your pain, your tears. I don't need to hear that anymore. I don't need to see you crying alone in the stall in the bathroom or hiding in the closet. I don't need to see you trembling every time you're wondering if you're going to come out. I don't need that pain in your heart. And I'm going to do it for you. I'm going to do it first. I am somebody. So can you all stand up just right where you are? Just quickly stand up as you're able. And I want you to demonstrate this. I want you to prove this as loud as you possibly can in a way that tells even the people who are trying to escape right now and leave that you have a voice, not for yourself or for your awkwardness or because you think this is hokey. Practice it now. And when you say it with every sinew of your body, in your bones, from your marrow, from your blood. Say, I am somebody. Repeat after me. I am somebody. I am somebody. I deserve full equality. Right here, right now, I am somebody. I am somebody. I am somebody. You are somebody. We are somebody. Go ahead and sit down. You sound so good. You sound real good. You can clap for yourselves if you want. I'll clap for you. Don't you ever forget the power that that has, not only for yourself, but for all the people who can hear, all the people in earshot. Remember the poem that I started off with from the very beginning. I talked about the poet. We remember him 700 years from now. Mutanabbi. He is the most famous Iraqi poet in all of history. I need to tell you a little backstory about this poem, though, this poem of identity. No other poet wanted to write it. This king, this very famous, powerful sovereign, this majesty and high mightiness, decided he wanted to self-aggrandize. He wanted to be remembered for all of history. He wanted statues of himself. He wanted to be memorialized in the very words and vocabulary that people recite 700 years later. And he said, write me a poem. Mutanabbi was the only one who dared to do it. Mutanabbi. Al-khaylu wal-laylu wal-baydaw ti'arifuni. The horses in the night in the desert, they know who I am. They know me. Wasayfu wa-ramhu qattasi wa-qalamu. The sword and the spear, the pen and the scroll, they know who I am. They know me. I am the one that can make the deaf to hear my poetry. I am the one that can make the blind to read my prose. They know me. They know who I am. The funny thing about this, 700 years later, this king, nobody remembers his name. They know me. They know me. They know me. We don't know you. And nobody remember you. They remember the name of the guy who dared to write it with the little skill that he had. Mutanabbi, son of a very poor woman, had no credentials himself at birth. He's reminding us, it's not about the one who ends up most rich. It's not about the one who was born most rich. It's not about the one even who gets the best grades. It's the one who dares to use what little they have. And that's the poem that I was most inspired by. And we have an American version of that. We learned that in the civil rights movement. This little light of mine. I want you to remember this throughout your next semester here. This little light of mine. You know, it was a civil rights song. I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine. Let it shine, let it shine. What's the meaning of that? this little light of mine. Why we got to say little? Because it doesn't matter if what you got in your hand is a fancy flashlight from a department store or a hand-me-down that's still flickering. No matter what country you come from, no matter what your first language was, no matter what your sexual orientation, no matter what color or creed, no matter what your riches that you end up with or what your mama and daddy gave you, you don't, that doesn't count. What counts is that with what you have, this little light of yours, you would let it shine. That will be remembered. And people will ask you 50 years from now, Grandma, Grandpa, what did you do in that time when the struggle for these people's rights was going on? Maybe they'll be gay and they say, what'd you do for me at that time? You were sitting here. Did you say, I would have felt awkward. Oh, I didn't want to push too hard. My career, I'll wait till 10 years or 20 years or till my parents are dead. Or did you say, this little light of mine, and I hope you will. I hope that you fall in love. I hope that you find out what that means. Before getting straight A's, I hope that you find out what your gay friends are going through. I hope that you will let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Thank you.
So right now we're entering our question and answer period. If you have any questions for Lieutenant Daniel Choi, please line up behind this specific microphone. We have a podcast on, so this is the only microphone that can pick that up, and ask any questions you may have.
You better have some questions, because I'm judging you.
Thanks for your talk. I was born and raised in San Francisco, obviously a very open-minded environment, but I have friends going into teaching now, yeah. And so they're being teaching assistants in different parts of the country, and they're confronted in their classrooms, usually elementary school kids, with sometimes anti-gay bullying among kids or taunts of straight kids to presumably gay students, and they are at a loss because having been raised in such an open-minded environment, they're not really sure if the job of a teacher is to sort of parent students in the way that you would want to parent students coming from an open-minded background. So my question for you is, what do you think the role of teachers and of public school systems is to address homosexuality the way that racism or anti-Semitism might be addressed in terms of consequences and lesson plans, and how can that be addressed so it's taken as seriously?
So what's the role of the school?
Yeah, the role of a teacher is the role of a school, and should it be similar to that of a parent who has a certain belief system?
Great question. Thank you so much. What's your name?
Glennis.
Thank you. How many of you are going to be teachers, do you think, one day in your life? Wrong. You all already are teachers. You just taught me that you were wrong. Everybody has that responsibility. So I guess to the larger point that you're asking, what's the purpose of schools? Right? I would ask that to you. Why the hell are we here right now? Why the hell are we at school? What are we supposed to learn here, if not to prepare for citizenship? I think when you think about what a role of a parent is, there are some people who don't have parents, right? There are certainly gay people who want to fulfill the role of some of those orphans that are given up or abandoned, or just you can't afford to have some of those kids. I think it is the role, not only of San Francisco people, so I'm not just going to answer this question particularly to that area, but the whole world. And the bottom line is, if parents knew how to raise their kids to respect all people, we wouldn't have to have this kind of place, but we wouldn't even have to have schools, would we? People could just do what the parents taught them, but something's missing. And there's something greater about being here at this school or any school. You teach each other by the example that you give, but a teacher must facilitate that. And a teacher can do that. They've done more than what they're afraid of. So maybe for them, for those people who are afraid, those teachers who are afraid to do their job as educators and teachers and people who rear the new citizenship generation, Maybe you can have the kids do your job for you, teacher, because they could probably do a better job than you could.
Hi. I was just wondering, how do your like friends and family as of now treat you as an openly gay man? Like, do they accept you?
Thank you. What's your name?
Nicole.
Nicole. Not everybody is as sweet as you, Nicole, by asking such nice questions. My parents and I, we don't talk. And my parents did make progress, but it's not an easy thing. Because I want to have a nice Cinderella story for you, but it's not that way. After 3 years, it's gotten worse, and after those 6 months, I decided that I needed to make an ultimatum. The last conversation that our parents had, after many tearful, yelling conversations, and they wanted to have a demonic exorcism for me because they believed that it would cure me. They do prayer circles and they fasted for me, and it didn't work. And I'm still gay, and they just need to realize that. But it's very difficult because I wanted very much for my parents to just accept the truth of who I am, and I wanted to also tell the public that there's hope for you if you just tell the truth. But the bottom line is, it's not easy, and it's not supposed to be easy. But I am who I am, and I am not going to stop being me. And I've had many conversations with my dad, particularly, and I want to just focus on him. I know you've asked about a lot of people, but he said that I would one day, my Korean name means is pronounced Chaed Dong-uk, which they were very proud of this name. They said, you're going to be like a leader from the East. You know, it means east and light and high or whatever. Some kind of feng shui stuff that they're trying to put on my life. But I said, you know, if you want me to be a leader for minorities, which is everything that they've always wanted for me, they said, then you got to realize that I have more than one minority within me. You know, I have more than one identity. And when I talked to my dad about why I'm being as loud as I am, because he said, you turned my house, this is after Rachel Maddow, you turned my house a gay headquarters! And I said, you're damn right! Gay headquarters. You thought that his house was his gay headquarters. You know, I just wanted to say, everybody thinks that coming out on Rachel Maddow show on MSNBC, that was in 2009. Everybody thinks that that was the hard thing. Everybody thinks that that was like the gauntlet. No, my parents were like drill sergeants compared to Rachel, but that was the easiest one to come out to. And so when I had a conversation with my dad eventually, he said, I don't know why you keep doing this as loud as you do. I mean, you could have just told me and that would have been the respectful thing. But I said, no, Daddy, because you taught me one thing. By your personal example, you taught me one thing. You came from Korea to America. For what? To make the next generation's lives better. And what do you think I'm trying to do? It might not be literally my generation. I'm not going to get pregnant and have a baby, you know, right now. But as much as I try. I am not going to be able to have that in the near future. Just to make the point clear, what I want you to know is that there's a larger idea of the next generation. And it's a civil rights movement. And for all civil rights movements, we must remember this. The greatest support that we get is not from the people who are currently living. I don't worry about what you guys will write about me on your blogs tomorrow. I don't worry. You can write good things or bad things. I read the comments sometimes. You guys can tweet. Yes, you guys can keep talking and saying all these things. And many people have said some very interesting things in the past 2 years. But I will remind you that if you're looking for inspiration, to keep on going, because this stuff is not easy. And remember, your support comes from the people who are not born yet. The people that detract, the people that criticize, the people that tell you too soon, too fast, too much, too loud, they're not going to be your greatest supporters anyway. Think about those people. You're young, but think about those people who are even younger. They look to you for guidance, yes, you've been told that many times, but they're also your greatest support. And it's hard to realize that, but as far as that goes, everything's going pretty damn well.
Hi, thank you for being here tonight. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the perspective of gays from the military. You didn't talk about that much in your speech, so I'm wondering, I'm in the ROTC program here on campus.
Thank you for willingness to serve.
I'll be eventually a second lieutenant, so I'm personally interested to see, you know, how your fellow soldiers reacted when you came out.
Yeah.
And I'm also interested to see what you think about gays in the military going forward, now that Don't Ask, Don't Tell has been repealed.
Thanks. It's a lot of questions there. What's your name and rank? And
Sean.
What branch you want to go?
Infantry.
Hope. All right. Hoorah. That's a whole another discussion. But thank you for your willingness to serve. I just wanted to applaud that and anybody here who's serving or who has served. Let me just point out one person. I'm going to make him stand up. He's sitting back here in this corner. He just wrote a book about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Can you believe it? We have Alexander Nicholson. Please, everybody, thank you for your service. I'm doing this just to embarrass you, Alex. He did just write a book. It's going to come out at the anniversary of Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, which is this Friday, 1 year. And it would answer a lot of the political, ideas. I'm not going to talk about the politics of a lot of it. Alex wrote a great book, a comprehensive book, a big, thick book. If it had more pictures, I would have read it. When I came out to my unit, everybody was afraid, because you heard, and you guys probably heard the debate, right? You're going to affect what? Unit cohesion, whatever the hell that is. Right? How many of you knew what unit cohesion meant, like before you even heard about Don't Ask, Don't Tell? It's not a word that people talk about. And in fact, there's a made-up term, unit cohesion. What it basically means is certain people are not popular enough, therefore they don't get to serve. That's how it's translated. It's the stupidest term, and it's the most ridiculous policy point that anybody could ever bring up in a debate. Unit cohesion, right? And so they all felt that if a gay person comes out, then what? Some people were saying that we would need a draft, that because so many people would quit. And that is the greatest insult, that you would call straight soldiers who were able to go to war, straight and closeted, mind you, who were able to go to war, strong enough, men and women, and they would come back, and all of a sudden there's a gay person or a lesbian in their unit, and then, I can't deal with this, I'm so scared, I'm going to quit. And you call them quitters, and that's some kind of a policy debate? You call them quitters, and you're saying that you won the debate? I think you lost the debate and you lost the war. Nobody quit my unit, right? But many people assume they did. So the conversation, I answer many questions like this. So this is in my mind, I could go in three different directions here answering your question. So I would try to, let's talk about sex. Let's go that direction, right? Because I know that was on your mind. No, I do not talk about such things. Everybody thought that if gay people were allowed to go into the army, openly gay, then they would swish around and we would all like wear tight uniforms and show our crotches and our boobs and, oh look, he's getting a phone call. And I said, really? You're so worried about it because what? Because you think that we're going to sexify or bring sexy back, to the army? I thought they were very sexy already. You don't have to, and it was like, we don't want them to be too sexy, we just wanted to, we're already kind of sexy, we know it. So I wondered, how do you get into a debate about sex when it's clearly a part of the opposition's argument that say, you're just going to make everybody have sex, 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 sex. And these are like 80-year-old grandmas that were like saying this. And I was like, I never knew that 80-year-old grandma would be so interested in my sex life. Maybe, I mean, I don't know what tips I can give her. She's probably more experienced than I am. So when we talked honestly about it, we cut through all the BS. And we said, this isn't about sex, is it? If it was, then the conversation would go like this. Sure, what happened when you come out? Oh, well, I came out and then I thought I was the only gay person, but it was like, oh, really, you weren't the only gay person? Oh, no, I woke up and I looked at the person next to me and I say, oh, you're gay too? And then all of a sudden, everybody in my squad said, I'm gay, I'm gay, I'm gay, I'm gay, I'm gay. You're so gay. You know what? Why would I? That's what everybody assumed. that everybody would turn gay. The whole army would turn gay because of me. I didn't know I had that much gay power. You know, I didn't know I was so influential. I know gay people, you know, that we're pretty influential. But I know we're always fashion forward. We're always, you know, coiffing our hairs. We're always, you know, we smell like lavender. But I mean, what are you so afraid of? And people will say, if you do this, then you will sexify the military. They use that same argument about black people, about Jewish people, about women. And all of the arguments, they say, well, if you bring these people in, then no white person will want to shower with a black person. No white person would take the order of a black person. No, and they use the same things. It's not just because we are gay or because it's our sexual orientation. It's because we're a minority and because scapegoating always happens in that. So the assumption is, and everybody wants a juicy story, it was the most boring coming out that I could have ever imagined. I was like, I came out for this? I came out for what? You guys are supposed to like protest me or something. You know, I thought they would have, like, the God Hates Fags people. I was like, where are they? Where's my parade, people? You know? So I felt gypped. I mean, I felt dissed by the entire system here. And everybody's like, no, come on. I mean, some people probably were a little bit uncomfortable, right? Some people, did you all go to the shower? Did you go to the shower? The shower? The shower? The shower? The shower? Shower, shower, shower. And everybody's, like, repeating this. What about the bathrooms? Bathrooms, bathrooms. The shower, 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 shower. Our children, children, children. You know, and you're probably going to hear some commercials in the next few weeks about, like, saying exactly the same thing. I said, yeah, you know. I play into it. And I said, you know, yeah, we all woke up the next morning, and we because we were all gay, and because sex was the only thing that gay people think about, you know. I had to remind them that we also think about, you know. Halloween and what we're going to wear. We think about, you know, how to be the best dressed at your weddings. You know, we think about these things are big drama. You know, I can't talk about and think about sex all the time. I gotta spend most of my energy fixing straight people's problems. So when I talk about sex, they think, oh well, that's probably what happened. That's probably what happened. So I joke with them. I say, yeah, everybody just had a big freaking orgy. All around the battalion, the whole battalion. Everyone was having sex, all up and down the battalion. And I was a leader, so I said, you know, some people gonna be tops, and some people gonna be bottoms. And then we are going to cross train on our weapon systems. I learned this at West Point. So it was like from midnight to 2 a.m., these people were tops. And then from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m., these people were bottoms. But they had to switch, and they had to rotate, you know, and so we did it like PT. We were all, like, doing push-ups and sit-ups. Not those kind. Is this really what they're going to say and call it a debate? And I joke, that actually didn't happen. I thought it would be a very interesting thing to write in a book. Alex, next book you write, you could write about that. It was so boring, the way that I came out. I was the leader of the range, which you're shooting rifles and you're qualifying on your weapon systems before you go to war. And we did such a good job. Everybody was just shooting their weapons. And a lot of the older generation gay people, veterans, Navy people, Army people, Marines, they were gay. And they said, well, you know, I came out when after I retired. And so it was safe for me. You better watch out, Choi. You just came out on TV. And so they say, you better watch your back. And so when I was leading the rifle marksmanship for my infantry battalion, my infantry unit, it was really my company and then the entire battalion. So it's 100 people and 1,000 people. I was walking up and down range, and I was, you know, helping people with their shot groups, and then we would walk all the way back. Now, they had loaded weapons. They had ammunition. These were infantry men. I'm an infantry officer. There's only men in those units. There's still gender discrimination in the infantry units. So if I was to be afraid of anything, I'd be afraid at that moment. I didn't know. And because of what everybody else planted in my head that I should be afraid, I kind of gave it credence when it didn't need to have any. I came through that entire thing. We did it so well. We trained the entire, we were only supposed to train 100 people, but we trained the entire battalion, 1,000 people, and other battalions from Philadelphia and other cities came, and they came onto our unit. And so I was telling people to shoot or to, you know, to fire or cease fire and put, you know, weapons on safe, all of that stuff. You're bringing back, it's like PTSD here. I thought nobody knew I was gay because of that. I thought, you know, even 1 week after coming out on the Rachel Maddow Show, it's in the Army Times, and so I thought, man, there's a big literacy crisis in the Army. We don't even know how to read. That must be it. Because it was, like, I think it was page 2 or 3 of the Army Times in that, during that week. And many people were emailing me saying, I read your, you know, I read this, I didn't know, and this is great. Or some people were a little bit turned off. But in my unit, the people who knew that I spoke Arabic and I was useful to the team, not only that, but regardless of what my skills were, that I was willing to go to war with them. They looked at me, and we were getting drunk at the bar. That's what we do best. We're all hanging out, and I thought, man, nobody knows that I'm gay. This is a big problem. I'm not doing a very good job here. And so one and twos came up to me, commanders and subordinates and just old people. There was one guy who'd been there since like the Peloponnesian War, I think. He didn't know how to do anything but be in the Army. And he came up, and every one of them, they said, we heard. And we know, in case you think we don't. And we've been talking about it all weekend. For 3 days we've been talking about it. And we think it's fucking awesome. That's how military people talk. So, and then afterwards somebody said, if you can be honest about that, if you can tell the truth about that, we're going to go to war when we have heard that officers sell out like crazy. Sell out meaning you throw your kids under the bus. You throw your subordinates for the sake of your own career and your own rank and your own progression. That's what they hate the most, you know. You're going to be an officer. You know, you want to piss off your unit most, you worry about being a first lieutenant, captain, general before you worry about them. And then you see yourself being thrown under the bus. But they saw that, and they say, you're not looking about your rank. You're not looking about your paycheck. You're not looking about your pension. And if you can tell the truth about that, then that's the kind of person that we will trust to go to war with you. We will go to war with you, shoulder to shoulder. And one person came out to me right then and there. He said that he was going to study to be a doctor then. He wasn't sure by that point because he didn't know if Don't Ask, Don't Tell was going to be repealed. He's still in. And he's helping other people throughout their coming out. We found out that we do have a good amount of gay people in our unit. And the old guy was the funniest. He said, sir, we know. And you better not think that you're special. Because we have had gay people, we do have gay people, and we're always gonna have gay people. This is exactly, if you can't understand me, that I'm just being, you know, good to his imitation. And you're still a lieutenant, and you ain't nothing special. Don't come around saying, like, I'm gay, so I'm special, I'm gay, so I'm special. You ain't nothing, you still nothing. So I realized that when these master sergeants say the same thing to these lieutenants, which that is their job, to give lieutenants a hard time, then the Army is going to be totally fine. Unit cohesion is going to be totally fine. Mission accomplishment is still going to be totally fine. And all of the debate about the hypotheticals that we've had about don't ask, don't tell, you remember, that was the most difficult debate we could ever had because of the practical application of what it really meant on the ground, what it looked like. Remember that in all gay rights and all progressive movement, when we are trying to fight for something that people don't know about yet, they haven't seen and touched and felt and smelled yet, it's difficult. We have a hard time messaging as progressive people because we don't know what that world will actually be. When you look back on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, they were saying all those same things, that people are going to quit, there's going to be mass resignation, people are just going to have sex, there's going to be an orgy, they're not going to listen to gay commanders. They're not going to listen to the people. It's going to be just like wreaking havoc, just like when they let black people and Muslims and women and none at all. And we don't want that again. They're in time of war. They said that so much. And they needed to just do this. And they didn't. And now they look really stupid. That applies to every single progressive movement, doesn't it? when we talk about immigration, getting more talented people here, when we talk about the environment, saving the world for the future, when we talk about marriage, when we talk about family, when we talk about, they say, well, you're going to make this world into a na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. And then all you have to tell them is you are wrong on this, you are wrong on everything else. Just see the world as it must be, rather than what you're saying it must be, which is really just a world that is going in the past.
Thank you.
I'm a little short. You've changed my life in a lot of ways, and it's sort of odd because I never thought of myself as a military person, but I gave birth to a kid who's a lieutenant in Afghanistan right now. Freaked me out. But I met you online. I signed your petition because my pastor, not your dad, was Ann Gordon. One day, several weeks later, my pastor was Drew Phoenix. And he came out to my son, my youngest son, first. And he said, hey, James, I'm not going to be Ann anymore. I'm going to be Drew. And James was like, really? How cool is that? And Drew said, yeah, that's why I told you first. But then we had to fight the United Methodist Church. And I don't know if you know about what's going on in the United Methodist Church this week. But there's a bishop, Melvin Talbert, I think his name is. And he's coming up and saying, y'all can't discriminate anymore. You really, really can't. You got to take it out of the discipline. So you're touching me on a number of levels, right? And I am a high school GSA faculty advisor.
Thank you so much.
I don't know what to do.
That's a gay straight alliance, right?
Yeah, it's a gay straight alliance, and I don't know what to do. I've got these kids who can't come to our meetings because they're scared to death. I got 13 kids' permission slips to come tonight to fill up these seats, and you notice I sat by myself because their parents wouldn't let them come. I've got kids who want to come to our meetings, but they're afraid to. So my question to you is, you've already touched my life a lot. Help me figure out how to get these kids to come, to be able to come. What can I do? Where can I go? I have no more ideas. We don't live in a little backwater town. We live in Baltimore. We live in a big, small metropolis. I need to know how I can assure these kids that they can come into this classroom and they can talk about what they want to talk. They can talk about Dan Choi and they can emulate Dan Choi and they can go to the Naval Academy because really in Baltimore we don't go to West Point, we go to the Naval Academy, sorry.
Beat Navy.
Beat Army. I'm a Navy mom.
Okay, this conversation ain't going to stop.
So what do I do?
Thank you so much for that question. I think, well, forgive you for the comment there. I never answer questions like that when people ask me desperately, what should I do? Tell me what to do. I tell them always in return, you have the answer already organically within. You ask those children. And have we asked those children what the issue is? The children are being abused by their parents. And until we can get legislation that calls the closetedness of children and the closetedness of straight people, straight children not able to have those conversations, calling that child abuse and mandating by our laws, by the force of our law, that when you do that, I'm not just discriminating against your religion, I'm telling you that your religion abuses my people, and I know your religion. Your religion is a beautiful one, except for when it does ugly things. And so it needs to stop. That's what you as an adult can do. If those children are able to go up there, then don't put that on me. You have the answer. You need to talk to the, and when you bring this about all these other people, because everybody in here will ask me, what do I do? What can I do? What can I as a straight person do? Right. You know, and let me just say and I'm very sorry that you weren't able to get your question in. You can come up afterwards and we can have a conversation. For straight people, I want to thank you all for being here. When straight people ask me, as a gay activist, what must the way forward be? What must I do? What must we do? Well, first of all, I appreciate that when somebody asks me that. Straight people, you have already shown the truth of the intersectionality, that inextricable tie, tied at the hip, both of us, gay and straight. Because if gay people are not equal in this country, then straight people are not equal either, and we have not manifest the promise of America. And it's obvious why gay people need straight people, because straight people make gay people. And so we want to thank you for making us, and I hope that you keep on making more of us. You have literally birthed this movement, and I hope you keep on having straight sex. I don't begrudge that, because what comes out of it is gay people, and therefore gay sex. So thank you so much. I want to thank the school. I want to thank all of you for being here in the community as well.
Here in Shriver.